Friends, it's a joy to be here this morning. I want to do three things very briefly while I'm here with you this morning. Firstly, I'd like to invite you on a journey with me as we engage in some cultural analysis. And then in light of that analysis, I want to ask the question, what is mission as we think about our present cultural context? And third and finally, if you will bear with me, of course, I'll say a few things about CMS. But firstly, cultural analysis. It was that great Christian thinker, G.K. Chesterton, who said, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in everything. Now, my experience is that's quite true. A few months ago in Hobart, they celebrated what's described as the Dark Mofo Festival. It's a festival of the dark. And the highlight was advertised was this. It was the procession which followed a large parrot shaped Ogo Ogo. People were encouraged to write their fears on post-it notes and to place them on the parrot, which was then set alight, a communal ritual of purification and renewal to deal with our fears. Now, friends, there is nothing new about any of this. Fear and power is a dominant worldview in many cultures around the world. That is, people trust and invest their identity in things they hope will have the power to protect them from evil spirits, a variety of fears, and the elements of nature. It's the same in Australia. People now trust and invest their identity in all kinds of things, hoping they'll deliver meaning and security, such as health and wealth and happiness. And this is all part of a change Australian culture has undergone or is undergoing when it comes to identity. So to put it another way, we are moving from an innocence guilt framework with a focus on rules, that's regulations, what's right, what's wrong, to what is described as a pain pleasure context. Maximizing pleasure, minimizing pain, embracing the things that bring happiness, seeking to keep at bay or rejecting those things that don't. Are we imagining this? Or is something really going on? Is this something you can relate to? After all, did your parents ever say to you, as long as you're happy, that's all that matters? But what if you're not happy? What if you've invested your identity in something that doesn't deliver? As one article in The Age recently put it, our pursuit of happiness is making us more anxious than ever. A few months back, I was on a tram in the city. A young adult was on the phone across from me and I listened. It's a bit hard not to sometimes. She was talking with earphones on. And have you ever noticed how some people, when they're talking on the phone with their earphones, they speak really loud? And to the question about happiness, which I'm pretty sure is what she was being asked, she said this, true, because I pretty well memorized it verbatim and then wrote it down. She said to that question, I want financial freedom. I want others to respect my thoughts and contributions. I need to do something that will make the world a better place. And if I get those things, I'm pretty sure that'll make me happy. Now, when you're only a meter and a half away, you're sort of listening intently to all of this. And I was thinking, well, what if you don't get those things? Or what if you get them and you're still not happy? Was she just speaking for all millennials, giving voice to this pain-pleasure paradigm? or was she echoing a now wider cultural trend? Now, bear with me. Culturally, aren't questions increasingly informed with pain pleasure categories in mind? Think same-sex marriage. Or ongoing discussions, now legislation, around assisted suicide. With same-sex marriage, the question asked was, how can you deny me pleasure? And with assisted suicide, it is, how can you now force on me a painful death? Questions of right and wrong aren't given much authority at all. What really counts is how people feel, and religion doesn't come into it at all. Indeed, religion is bad anyway, isn't it? It promotes hate and hurts people. Which leaves us with the question. In a happiness-obsessed culture, how can Christians engage with this pain-pleasure dynamic? Now, one response is just to bunker down. I remember being a cross-cultural worker in Europe for 6 years. I was based in Lausanne, and I still remember on Sunday mornings waking up to the sound of beautiful bells ringing across Lausanne, emanating from beautiful architectural buildings that were largely empty. And the mindset really was something like, we've just got to get Christians together and keep them Christian. There was something of that mindset in the GBU, the student group I was asked to work with. I still remember not long after we'd arrived being told by the leader, the GenSec, that he'd been told by his governing board, look, you can do a little bit of evangelism, but don't make that your focus. Just engage with the Christians. That's one response. Another response is to head in a direction where we're encouraged to separate life from faith and for it to be a very private thing. And I still remember one of the things my wife and I did going around the universities and trying to engage with Christian faculty, encouraging them to get involved in the student ministry by praying for them and being involved in mentoring and discipling and all kinds of things. And I still remember being struck, even at the time, by the response of one Christian faculty member who said, why would I want to do that? That Christian stuff has got nothing to do with me. When I'm at work, that's what I'm paid to do. My faith has got nothing to do with it at all. Do you see? This dynamic of separating as if there is something that's spiritual and things that are not. Sadly, many of the Swiss Christian students had something of that mindset. I remember meeting an Egyptian student, not a Christian, from a Muslim, if not probably nominally Muslim background, saying that they'd been in Europe, Switzerland, for at least 2 years, and they still hadn't met a Christian. And they knew nothing about the Lord Jesus. Many Christian students were slow to state publicly they were Christians. Some Swiss friends thought the culture was like that partly because religion was seen as divisive. Perhaps some kind of a leftover of a disastrous religious wars that affected that continent over quite a lengthy period of time. And yet non-believers, even in a university context, were involved in a science-based context, still had an interest in faith and religion. Indeed, not long before we arrived, the GBU organised a debate between a well-known Christian apologist called John Lennox and a well-known atheist, and 1,000 students attended. And you know what the response was by the university hierarchy to that event? This is not satisfactory. We must not have anything to do with events like this. So much for universities being the melting pot of ideas. And in Australia, we now see an interesting dynamic where people are really struggling in public space to engage with each other. In fact, if we've ever been a culture of compassion, many have described it as we've gone from a culture of compassion to a culture of contempt, where people just seem unwilling or unable to engage with each other around ideas, around all kinds of things, where discussion on a number of topics, including religious discussion or religious opinions, are shut down. Think Israel Falau. Okay, so that's our cultural context that you and I are living in. Much like Europe, certainly increasingly and aggressively secular in Australia. So what is mission in this context and how does it work in practice? You know, I still think it comes down to investing in people and arousing curiosity in the person of Jesus. In a pain-pleasure context, friends, we need to arouse curiosity. And don't be surprised, given what I've just said, if you get into an honest conversation with a friend, a non-believer, or someone who really has nothing to do with Christians or religion in general, don't be surprised if they say something like, increasingly these days, that Christianity is abusive and manipulative. It promotes hate and hurt. Sadly, there is some truth in that, isn't there? When we think about how power and authority has been abused by some. They'll say Christians don't care about the marginalised. Now, hypothetically, and this could very well happen, in this situation you might say something like, I get why you might think that. But actually Christianity is about Jesus. And he always welcomed and loved people, and he never abused power. Would you like to hear one of his stories? And from my experience, people love stories. And you would say something like, Jesus had been at a house and he'd been speaking with people. And when he stopped speaking, someone stood up at his table and said, gosh, blessed are those who will eat at this banquet or feast, God's favored ones. But then Jesus turned to him and said, there was a man who held a great, great banquet. And he invited many, many guests. When the time for the banquet was ready, he sent his servant to those invited saying, come, come, everything now is now ready. Come. But they all alike began to make excuses. One said, I've just purchased a field and I'm on my way to see it. Please excuse me. Another said, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. And still another said, I've just got married. I can't come. When the servant reported this to the master, he was very angry. He said, quickly, get up, go out into the alleyways and go into the streets of the town and bring in the poor, the blind, the crippled and the lame. And the servant responded, Master, what you've asked has been done, but there is still room in the house. And then the master replied, well, then go out into the country lanes and the country highways and byways and force them to come in, for my house must be full. For I tell you, Not one of those men invited will ever taste my banquet. Now, friends, in that discussion, at that point, you'll say, what did you think of the story? What did you like? What surprised you? What did you learn about Jesus? And what did you learn about people? There are a number of questions you could ask and have a great discussion. And in that conversation, I'd probably say something like, because the points would come up, can you see, Jesus never abused anyone. In fact, he welcomed everyone. He spoke about relationship with God in practical ways, didn't he? It was like a party or a banquet put on by a great leader or a great king. And what did you think of the message? God's message to you and me, like those people, what, it's simply come to the party. Come, everything is now ready. Come, God's love is for you. It's for everyone. Rich and poor, insiders and outsiders, loved and unloved. It was and is a message of God's love and grace that people don't really deserve, but is still extended. And this welcoming love is the kind of love that has the power to challenge us and change us. It's what the people in Jesus' day had been waiting for, the coming of the kingdom and a coming of a king. But did you notice, when the king arrives, what do you find people doing? Other priorities. And remember their excuses? Buying fields and cows, falling in love, getting married. The king has come, and what are people doing? They're getting on with all the business of life. But I want to say, let's not misunderstand what Jesus is saying. I don't think he has a problem with commerce or marriage per se. But he's simply pointing out that when the king says, come, follow me, everything else is put aside or put into perspective because he's the number one priority. And think about it. It's one thing to turn down an invitation from a friend, but if it's the king of the world who is God inviting you, it's not just rude, it's crazy to turn down that invitation. And yet, that's what was happening in Jesus' day. And as I look around our world, I think it's still happening today. People, even religious people, put other things before God. But remember the story? How did the master react? He was furious. His own people won't come, the favored ones. So he issues an invitation to outsiders, anyone in fact, people who would never expect an invitation to come. That's why it's good news. Good news for those who are often overlooked. Good news for those who often feel forgotten, no matter who they are, no matter what they've done. God's invitation to come is for everyone, including you. Would you like to learn more about Jesus and why it's good news by looking at more of his stories? Now, friends, I used to have conversations with people just like that, using Bible storytelling regularly in Europe, as a way of engaging with this pain-pleasure dynamic. In a pain-pleasure context, we need to not just arouse curiosity in Jesus, but we also need to invest in people. To a culture that says Christianity results in hate and hurt, is abusive and exploitative, we must live Matthew 5 we must live, 1 Peter 2, which says, live such good lives among the not yet believers, though they may speak evil about us, yet when they see our good deeds, when they see our character, they will praise our Father in heaven. Friends, if the world is to see our love, it means giving people our most precious resource. And what is that? Our most precious resource is time, which is quite challenging in our time-poor cultural context, isn't it? The currency of love is time. And investing in people for the sake of the gospel will involve a rethink of our priorities and a rethink of what we put our identity in. It may mean letting go of the things we hold dear so that at times we can put the needs of people, often people not like us, before our own. Pretty challenging if you think about it. How do we do mission in practice? Well, as I think back on my time in Europe, it involves some soul searching. Student ministry at times was slow and hard. And I discovered that I had my identity in being productive and being able to control things, or at least having the illusion of control. And yet God was so kind and gracious in taking my head knowledge of my identity and my worth in Christ and actually moving it to a heart, understanding and a heart experience, showing me afresh his grace and his love, which was quite liberating because it freed me to just enjoy hanging out with international students. Students like Stig, a Belgian, who came to our social events, our international cafe, came into our home for meals, board game nights. We'd meet at the pub to talk about Europe, his life, his studies, his hopes, worldviews. And after a year, he told us and our team that he hadn't known he could feel so loved outside his family. It's quite a significant thing for a young adult Belgian student to say. And he flew back to see us on our final weekend before we left Europe, even though we hadn't seen him for 3 years. Or I think of a Chinese student we got to know well. After a while, she realized who we were and it was our job to be there. Put another way, we were missionaries. And so she spent a year trying to push us away. What she was really doing was testing to see if our love was real. And I remember asking God to help me love her because there were times where she was very unlovable. And yet God reminded me that it was none other than Jesus who had loved me at my most unlovable. In an email last year, this student told us that she would have found it hard to believe in the love of Jesus as she read the Bible if she hadn't first experienced that love through us. Do you see, friends? It was Christians investing in people. Christians modelling other person-centred love. That's what made the difference. In our cultural context, there is still a need to give a reason for our belief. I'm not denying that. But in Europe or everywhere, it often comes down to the quality of our relationships. Cold turkey evangelism, inviting people to gospel forums, may still have a place. But I'll say again, what is crucial is a long-term commitment of Christians to good relationships. That's what's needed. A long-term commitment to people in relationships over a long period of time, giving those people the opportunity to hear the gospel regularly and for those people to have a good, positive experience of Christianity and Christian people. That's how mission works in practice in our cultural context. How do we do mission? Yes, it's certainly about looking for opportunities to share our faith verbally, but also demonstrating it. And this is about seeing people the way God sees them. So let's be curious about people who are not like us. Let's listen well. Let's love practically. And as they share their story, see how God's big story connects with their story. Or to put it another way, how the gospel speaks into their lives. Because it does. We just need to be curious enough to work out what those connecting points are, and we can't do that unless we're invested relationally. But let's not forget, God is going to hold a big party, and everyone is invited. And the message is a very positive and practical and challenging one. Come, God's love is for you. Come, it's for everyone. Now, which brings me to CMS. Our vision is for a world that knows Jesus. Our aim is to provide a ministry of encouragement to local congregations, much like this one, in the area of cross-cultural mission or cross-cultural engagement. How do we do this? Three very quick points. Firstly, we want to support you in your connection with your local community. And that's why we run events like Summer Under the Sun, we run workshops, we run all kinds of things that are aimed at growing the cross-cultural capacity of communities of faith, much like this one. So in Summer Under the Sun to come, 2020, we'll have Peter Adams speaking about prayer, what it is, and our experience of why it undergirds all of mission. But we've invited also a man called Jackson Wu, who is an expert in the area of, I'll use the word, then I'll explain it, contextualizing the gospel. What does that mean in English? He's ever so good at helping us to understand how to explain the faith in ways that people who are from very different cultural backgrounds from us can understand. If they come from a fear power background, or power on a shame, or innocence, guilt, or pain, pleasure. And there'll be workshops, and there'll be all kinds of opportunities to think about how we can grow our abilities, our soft skills, to be able to connect with people who are not like us. So that's firstly what we're on about. Secondly, we're ever so keen, of course, to raise up long-term cross-cultural workers who will work with congregations much like Berwick around the world to see a world that knows Jesus. Cross-cultural workers like the Jacksons, thank you so much for your partnership with them in Japan. We're ever so keen to see how the Lord might be working in congregations like this one to raise up even more long-term cross-cultural workers, not just to work here, but to work also in other contexts around the world. And thirdly, finally, we're very keen to use our cross-cultural experience to help you in seeing a Berwick that knows Jesus. Our Bible storytelling, understanding culture, growing skills in this whole area is what we do, and it's pivotal. So if you have any questions at all about anything that I've said today, I'd really love to engage with you and about how CMS might encourage you and partner with you as you seek to represent God well, wherever God has placed you, as you seek to exercise a sphere of influence wherever God has put you. Thanks so much for your kindness and generosity inviting me along today. Amen.